the April 16, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning to everyone. We have a full house this morning. We have some folks who need to make some comments and then get off to another meeting. So I'm going to hear House Bill 2429 first and open a public hearing on that bill. And I'd like to call up first, please, Bob Shiprack and Hasina Squires. I understand that there are amendments coming to this bill that aren't ready as yet.
That's correct.
Okay. Maybe the two of you could just kind of...
Yep. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council, here in support of House Bill 2429. It is a gut and stuff. The amendments are not prepared. I have shared the concepts with folks that I believe would have an interest. You'll probably be hearing from them after we get done talking, but I wanted to just conceptually, very briefly, go through two points that I wanted to put into this bill. These are points that those of you on the full committee have already heard, so I can be brief. But I also wanted to just preface my remarks to say that part of my intent, at least, was in reaction to some of the opposition to the prevailing wage enterprise zone bill that is also in the full committee, and some of the misinformation that was given to that full committee, such as a Salem expert talking about that bill against it when the Salem Riverfront property is in an urban renewal district, not an enterprise zone, and then alluding that passage of that legislation would severely impact affordable housing, when next week you will have a bill in front of the full committee exempting affordable housing in urban renewals from any prevailing wage. And I just wanted to set the record straight.
Bob, for those who may be in the audience and not aware of the distinction between urban renewal and enterprise zones, could you just give or Hasina,
I'll try.
Either one of you?
Hasina is probably more of an expert on that, but they are distinctly different, different statutes. The enterprise zones were established by the legislature, I believe, in 1985, and various cities and counties can establish a zone. There are rural, there are urban, there's over 50 of them, I believe, 59 across the state of Oregon. Much different, even funded different in many respects between urban renewal districts and enterprise zones. So you gotta, they are separate. And in fact, in the legislature last session, the whole area, whole idea of urban renewal districts and prevailing wage was clarified. But
thank you.
The other comment, just very briefly, and I was hoping Representative Esquivel was here, there was another comment made that the Hogan Construction, who is the contractor for the South Medford High School, who is an out-of-state contractor, in the prevailing wage didn't do any good there. I went and got the list of subcontractors for that high school, the $80 million hospital, pardon me, high school. I was frankly very surprised at the high number of local contractors right from Medford, Oregon, that are building that high school, well over half, and well, probably three quarters are in fact Oregon contractors. And I will share that with the full committee, and I did give it to the committee administrator. To the bill in front of us, however, and thank you for just letting me have an opportunity to rebut some of the statements that were made.
Absolutely.
I have two issues conceptually. One is that we hope through the amendments to prohibit what are known as non-disclosure agreements, where you have a potential customer company coming into an enterprise zone. They and the zone sponsors sign these statements saying that you can't talk about what's going on, what the name of the company, what they do. They're given code names. Google was O2 up in the Dalles. It's got very, it's like 007 stuff around these enterprise zones. The problem with that is that the public doesn't know what's going on, or to some extent, people think they don't. I can recall talking about and I'll just use Google as a good example. It's an enterprise zone in the Dalles. My own business manager was required to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so he couldn't even talk to me about the project. That's how ridiculous some of this has gotten. I drove to the Dalles. I've told this to the full committee, and you know it's not hard in these little communities when you see two 250-foot cranes alongside Interstate 84 that maybe something's going on. I stopped and got some gas, and just for kicks, I asked the gas station attendant where the new Google plant was, and he gave me directions right to it. But I say that just to point out some of the, you know, ridiculousness of it. But it's very serious that the public doesn't know what's going on in their own communities. What are the tax breaks being given? Who's going to be employed? Who's even coming to town? And I think that's wrong. And I think that it should be looked at, and perhaps a little light shined on that process, or perhaps complete elimination. Although I will admit there are probably some things that are said behind closed doors that we acknowledge shouldn't be public information, that are proprietary perhaps, but to not let the public even know what's happening is, in my opinion, wrong. The second issue I've got is an open records issue. The researcher that I use on a variety of different projects, his biggest problem is when there's a private company who is the enterprise zone sponsor, in other words, putting everything together, is a private company, and then we ask for, you know, public documents. They say, well, we don't have to give them to you because we're a private entity, and therefore the open records law doesn't apply to us. That is also, I think, wrong. These are public documents. The facts that the city or county may have employed a private company to do the work, I don't have a problem with that, but to withhold public documents behind that facade, I also think is wrong. And my point of this, Mr. Chairman, if opening up the process, shining a little light, I think would help a great deal in smoothing out the bumps we have with this enterprise zone program, at least from my perspective. And I'll close just with one last example. Just east of town, in Salem here, there's a Sanyo plant being built. We didn't know about that plant until there was literally earth-moving equipment on the site. Luckily, I did finally, through a lot of hard work, get some answers as to even who the contractor was. I'm happy to say that almost 100% of that job is being done with local labor and contractors, thank goodness. I don't know if that was by design or accident, and frankly, much of it will be above prevailing wages paid on that project, which was some more misinformation that was given to the full committee. So that's all I got to say.
Bob, just a couple of questions here. Would you tie for us public money on these projects, and I think your attempt to make sure that we have open government here?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my experience, and this is probably, we can have the conversation today or some other time. In enterprise zone, it's more than just the tax abatement. I rarely have seen an enterprise zone where it was just a tax abatement. There's usually utilities. In Albany at the Gatorade project, hell, they put in a brand new wastewater treatment plant, new roads out to it, all paid by the taxpayers. And, of course, in that instance, what was a real tragedy is that Gatorade pulled the plug on the project, so you know, these projects, these public works, which we enjoyed building, and it was great, but I'm not sure it was the best use of the money. But in that particular project, there was $70 million of public subsidies. I'm told at San Diego it's $40 million, half the price of the project. But so, yeah, heavy public subsidies, very heavy public subsidies, and yet a very hard time even finding out basic information as to what's being built and who's building it, and my issue, who's going to build it.
And a lot of this is because of non-disclosure agreements that you mentioned in the earlier part of your testimony?
That non-disclosure and the open records law seem to be, there's more, but if we could address those two, it would be very helpful. I'd also throw in requiring public meetings as to what's coming into town and how it's being paid and what are the public subsidies being offered. In a SIP, you get more of that, a strategic investment program. It's required, but in enterprise zone, it's not.
Okay. Hasin, is it going to work better if you proceed and then we ask questions of both of you, or?
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay,
thank
great.
You, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasin Esquires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. A couple of changes to the Enterprise Zone statute that we would like to advance. Probably number one would be the least controversial on your piece of paper, and I would like to hear from the other side whether or not they would object to changing the legislative findings. I think that's something that we have consistently stated session after session, is that the legislative findings, we believe, do not really match the intent of the program any longer. We firmly believe that this is not a program to benefit rural Oregon. It is a statewide program. Everybody uses it. It's used more in urban areas, and that's where they're taking advantage of it. So the legislative findings ought to be corrected to match what is truly taking place with the 50-plus enterprise zones that are now that has now made the program a statewide program. So that would be change number one that we would like to the committee to consider. And then the second issue is the issue of opting out, which has been very controversial over the last couple of sessions. We've advanced proposals to allow all special districts to opt out, and the opponents of those types of amendments or legislation that we've advanced have said that makes it very complicated. It's very difficult to negotiate with an enterprise zone company seeking an enterprise zone because they won't have certainty who's going to be in, who's going to be out, what taxes are going to be abated, what are not going to be abated. We've heard that message. I disagree with it, but based upon the fact that we seem to garner a significant amount of opposition for allowing all special districts, including a vector control district that might levy 1 cent per thousand, the ability to opt out, that we just focus on two core services, public safety. So rural fire protection districts under our amendment would be allowed to opt out, and there's a specific process that would allow them to do that, and then school districts, because after all, if we're trying to put more money in education, shouldn't be really any reason to abate school district taxes if the legislature is just going to have to backfill it.
And Hasina, could you give us an example of why it would make sense to possibly back out rural fire districts?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think last time I appeared before the committee, I brought up the example of Precision Cast Parts. So Clackamas County Fire District Number 1, large fire district in Clackamas County. Precision Cast Parts seeks an enterprise zone designation, or the county does. Precision Cast Parts applies. Construction occurs. The fire district has to provide additional services to provide those services to that construction project or whatever is being built or ultimately is going to be built. And from the district's perspective, it should be up to them whether or not they want to choose to abate the taxes and do more with less, or spread that burden, tax shifting burden, onto the existing district residents. So they would just, I think from their perspective, it is an increased demand on their service, unlike a library district, a vector control district, a parks and recreation district. It is a core service, and it is a function of construction that fire service protection is going to be needed.
Great. Thank you very much. And so you have, both of you have conceptually now described the amendments that have not come out of LC as yet. Thank you very much for that. Questions or comments from the subcommittee? Yes, Vice Chair Huffman, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. So, Bob, are we taking out the prevailing wage portion that was in the original bill? Or
yes, that's in another bill, 2699, in the full committee.
Okay.
This is has nothing to do with prevailing wage.
It's, okay.
I just wanted to use this opportunity because there are some people here on this committee to try and set the record straight over some of the comments that were made in the full committee. But it is related in that, Representative, I feel that if there was more disclosure, we wouldn't have these types of issues of, they're pretty basic misunderstandings. Let's just leave it at that.
Follow up,
please.
Bob, on the informational part,
mm-hmm.
we're competing with 49 other states to get, well, probably not 49 to get the Googles, but I'm assuming that Google was looking at Oregon along with probably at least three or four other sites, factoring in availability and cost of power and land size and all the components they were looking for, workforce. Do other states have the open information, or would this put us, because, I mean, you're right, I live in the Dalles, and the Google situation was humorous.
It was.
But they had stated, and whether it would have happened or not, they were very emphatic that if word got out as to who they really were and any of the project was being talked about, that they would pull the plug and they would go to one of the other locations that they had been looking at. If we had the open information and couldn't guarantee their anonymity and secrecy of the project, would that have put us at a disadvantage for getting Google?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, just 2 points. First of all, maybe Google's not the best example. They needed 25 megawatts of uninterruptible electricity. They had to tap directly off of the Dalles Dam, Bonneville Power Administration, so they were severely limited as to where they were going to locate a plant. There's another one going in up at right next to McNary Dam. Same, I think it's Yahoo or one of those. That's a big secret, too. Can't talk about it. So sometimes these decisions are made, and they're locating for a reason. It could be water. It could be, in this case, uninterruptible electrical supply. But the thing that I would suggest is that perhaps after a company has made a decision, we're going to do this, why can't we then know they've made a decision and then give people, contractors, labor, suppliers, an opportunity to say, hey, I'm available. You know, this, the whole intent of enterprise zones is to create jobs and economic prosperity. How do you do that if nobody knows what's going on? I mean, that's my point. That's my only point here. So I acknowledge there's certain anonymity that needs to occur, but at some point, well before there's putting bulldozers out on the ground, maybe people should be aware of this stuff and what it's costing the local taxing districts as well.
Okay. And just one more.
Please.
And Bob, since it doesn't affect this, but since you brought it up, I've always wondered, because you hear these terms thrown around a lot. Davis-Bacon, little Davis-Bacon, prevailing wage.
Yes.
What's the difference?
The Davis-Bacon Act is the federal prevailing wage law.
Okay.
There's also, within the Davis-Bacon Act, what we call HUD rates, which are for housing. So your housing authorities, for instance, that are funded by HUD, have a residential rate, which in outside of the Portland area hasn't been updated since 1979, and in fact some of the rates are below state minimum wage. Then there is the state, most people call it the BOLI wage, which is the state prevailing wage, which we establish annually by wage surveys. So you have federal, then you've got a federal housing, and then you have a state prevailing.
And that varies on different workforce regions or
there are 14 regions around the states that the Employment Department routinely uses, and annually they survey about 7,000 contractors to find out what is the wage and fringe packages paid in those 14 regions by craft. The contractors turn in the data, and the economists over at the state Employment Department crunch it, give it to the Boley Commissioner, and he approves it, and then it's published. So you have rates that vary from region to region. Oftentimes, and a lot of people behind me think those are all union rates. They are not. Not necessarily. Some are not. Depends on 50% of the hours worked. That's the test.
Last. So, as a follow-up on the Boley prevailing wage Davis-Bacon, there is a difference, or could be a difference
between the federal and the state. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. The federal government hasn't done a survey in Oregon for many, many years, at least 7 or 8, and then they didn't even publish it. So those rates typically, the Davis-Bacon rates typically have been union rates with some exceptions in Southwest Oregon where, for whatever reason, they, many years ago, but this is back in the 90s, we got rates as low as $10 an hour in Coos County for some crafts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And just to clarify it, this bill now is not dealing with that subject.
Not at all.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Additional questions or comments? Representative Holdy?
Thank you. Just a quick clarification for Representative Huffman, because he alluded to the Little Davis-Bacon. I don't know if Bob really addressed that, but the Little Davis-Bacon is generally our Boley established state prevailing wage rates.
Correct.
To differentiate that between the federal Davis-Bacon.
Okay,
but thank you. I just sort of had kind of a question for both of you, because Bob brought up the issue of not just the tax abatements, but also the subsidies that oftentimes happen with free utilities or as such. You know, I was shocked to find out in a prevailing wage or an enterprise zone and down in my area that the water and electricity was being provided at to the cost of the ratepayer, and the company inside the enterprise zone really wasn't paying much for their utilities. And I don't know if that's ever factored into the cost of the enterprise zone. And I don't know, Bob, if you've seen the Department of Revenue presentation on enterprise zones that has been going around this session, but some of the benefits of the enterprise zones are I guess somewhat questionable. Yes. as to the cost that we're the taxpayers are paying for those jobs. They're subsidizing up to 30% of the wages of those jobs, I think was the average statewide, which is a pretty spendy proposition. So, but notwithstanding that, I was curious whether Ms. Squire's proposal in this amendment where their special districts could opt out, I'm wondering if the utilities and ratepayers could opt out of enterprise zones too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I'm not aware of any special district that is providing free water, sewer, stormwater to a company located in enterprise zone. I think the example that you're using and giving might possibly be related to a city utility, and so if the city, like say for instance the city of Eugene was the enterprise zone sponsor, that perhaps they had negotiated into their agreement that entity would receive a lower or a free water service from the city, and that would be something that the city would be able to choose to do, but not I would hesitate to say that they could actually mandate that on a special district. So I think it would be something at the zone sponsor level. But no, to answer your question directly, no, none of the amendments that were number one or number two would not address saving the ratepayer from the city doing that.
Thank you.
Representative Dimble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I'm very sympathetic to your notion of that we need to keep things quiet during the mm-hmm. early stages, and then at some point, you know, the light of public awareness needs to be turned on. I think when exactly you make that transition may be a little tricky in some cases, but I think the basic principle really makes sense. And then, Hasina, how do you see this applying to the special districts? I mean, the amendment says that the districts have 60 days after the written agreement. How do you see the information awareness kind of process working for the special districts, and does that seem timely to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrough, this language actually in this amendment, it was back from 2005, that's how long we've been at this. It does seem reasonable, the timing. Previously, in several sessions ago, I can't recall when we advanced a proposal to require consultation and conferring with the taxing districts, and the enterprise zones do that now. They notify we're potentially going to seek designation of an enterprise zone. So there is a consult and confer component that absolutely takes place, and it's worked well. The way this would work is that the zone would notify, and then there would be a cutoff period. This, like within 60 days, the taxing district would then need to notify that they're, well, just the one taxing district would need to notify we're not choosing to participate in that. And I think, if I recall correctly, that timing did work, and it was an established process. I think at one point there was discussion about, well, how will we know if a district did opt in or opt out? And we need certainty, and we need deadlines, and we need actual written documentation, and so that's why it does require an ordinance or a resolution for the government to take affirmative action that provides certainty to that zone sponsor that they are not, in fact, going to participate in the abatement.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up, please. And does that consultation, I mean, in practice, happen within the cone of silence, I mean, the cloak of silence, or that's after the word is out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrough, that is a very public process. There are letters that are sent. Our association is copied on every enterprise zone potential designation that a city or a county is looking at designating one or renewing one. We get a copy of it. Every single taxing jurisdiction is notified. It's a public record, public document. It's done in a very public manner.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further?
Thank you both very much. Certainly appreciate that. And we will. You'll let us know when the amendments are ready then. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up, please. Looks like Sherry Wargren, and if that's not correct, I apologize. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Cherie Wargren with the City of Salem Urban Development Department. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak. I'm here to say that the city is concerned and not supportive of House Bill 2429. Several of the legislative concepts that have been circulating would add qualifications to how an enterprise zone is currently operated. Since I don't have the actual amendments, I will sort of address the concepts directly. Our concern is that these qualifications will act as barriers to the enterprise zone program, removing e-zones as a tool for business recruitment and job development at a time, as we all know, that we really need to be able to be competitive. Salem is adamantly opposed to the proposed language that would eliminate confidentiality, I know we've been talking about this, for e-zone sponsors, and would prohibit local governments from signing non-disclosure agreements with companies contemplating location within enterprise zone boundary. In our experience, confidentiality is a necessary part of the process in recruiting new business to our community. I have an email that I received from Taro Toyota of Inspect Group, LLC, who works nationally as a site selector for businesses, and I wanted to read you what his email said to us. I just want to mention that it is absolutely critical to be able to maintain confidentiality of project. Just like in case of Sanyo project, we have looked at 7 to 8 different states, and if city or states couldn't keep confidentiality, it could have jeopardized Oregon's chance for this project. project member typically contact banks or other public officials first because they think banks or public officials can keep secret better than anyone else. I have seen many projects went to other locations due to confidentiality issues. I recommend that city and public officials be able to sign confidentiality agreements so that people feel comfortable exposing important information when they're looking at sites. And I know that we've been talking about state-to-state competition, but I really think in 2009 it is global and not necessarily we're just competing with other states in the United States. I really think that it is now a global market that we're competing with. We also have concerns about the opt-out tax exemptions language that you're proposing. And enterprise zones are developed and managed to fit what's best in a local community. Zone sponsors already have the ability to work with affected districts on individual situation and do what's best for the local area. I want to piggyback off of what the lady just said. I just recently went through the application process for redesignation of our enterprise zone, and it was very prescribed as to the amount of time that we gave in notifying the special districts, right down to giving them a draft agenda, calling them, doing outreach, following up with minutes to anyone who did not attend that meeting. So we very much gave an opportunity for anyone who had concerns to come in and speak to us. And I can tell you that I had an educational representative come, and they wanted to know if I needed a letter of support. There was no issues the other way around. In fact, they understood very clearly the benefits in the community for putting in an enterprise zone in our area. With respect to the wage issue, we basically feel right now that we're diluting an incentive that, and one of the few tools that we have to recruit traded sector businesses in our community. We've had an enterprise zone designation since 1987, and in a 10-year period of time, we were able to recruit 48 businesses and 2,700 jobs. At a time when the economy is struggling and our unemployment is high, the benefits of the enterprise zone are critical to future job growth in our community. So we hope that we don't reduce these benefits, and again, we're not supportive of what's being proposed.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Questions or comments for Ms. Wargren, please? Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you. Wait, Sheree?
Yes.
Is there any compromise in working with companies? Is it possible to keep their technical information and business plan and those types of things that should be confidential, keep those confidential, and yet allow other types of information to be made more public? Or when you work with companies, does it seem to be in an either-or situation? It's either totally confidential, or we're moving on.
I am typically not the one negotiating those agreements. Ray Burstead with SEDCOR and the director of our department is. It's interesting because nobody wants to publicize something fabulous more than everybody. And I think if you're involved in a project like this, the list just becomes really long that everybody wants to be sure that they're included in the press release and we give credit where everything is due. My sense is it's probably a deal-by-deal situation. Probably all deals are not necessarily, the agreements are probably not all the same, but in our office alone, these projects do have titles that I know nothing about. They're in a locked cabinet. We, depending on if you're involved or not, know nothing about them. And it works that way if asked. I'm not going to breach any confidentiality, but I don't think it's probably blanketed.
Mr. Chair, comment. It might be interesting on this to actually hear, and if there's somebody in the room that qualifies, be interesting to hear from the local negotiators.
I agree.
For enterprise zones that put these deals together to kind of weigh in and tell us what the impact one way or the other could be. No impact or partial or...
I agree, Vice Chair Huffman, and this will not be the last time that we hear this bill, and maybe that's something that we can make arrangements for, at least in the work session. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps just a comment. Sometimes I understand the need for keeping confidentiality around a particular business's, internal processes or things of a proprietary nature that make their business through their own particular innovation, much more competitive in the marketplace, perhaps, but it seems like project confidentiality, which is, I think, what this bill is talking about, how much are we subsidizing these companies by, and where, who's getting these projects, who's going to be building them, and what exactly is the taxpayer giving up in terms of revenue to attract these businesses? Seems like a pretty reasonable request. I guess if we were at the state level to say, we're going to give away a bunch of potential revenue or a bunch of existing revenue, that the taxpayers, essentially our taxpayers' dollars, and send it down to Ways and Means and put it out in a budget somewhere and saying, hey, this is confidential, we don't want the public to know what this is, I imagine we would have a pretty large amount of people that would be outraged that we could, do budgets and keep them confidential. So I'm just sort of a little bit, outraged myself that, we have taxpayer investments going out into these companies and they're trying to keep all of this confidential and then using the threat that we will not come unless we have confidentiality and, the certain amount of subsidy or we're going to go somewhere else. It's sort of, I won't say blackmail, but it's like they're whipsawing our locality against some other unknown locality that's also bound by confidentiality, and seems like a pretty poor bargaining position to be in, from my perspective. I just think there ought to be a little bit brighter light on, what's happening with these enterprise zones and the amount of tax subsidy that's going into them. It seems like the public should at least be aware of some of those circumstances and conditions. Just, my thoughts on it.
Representative Holby, I can't speak on behalf of other jurisdictions with respect to how they've structured their enterprise zone. I know in Salem, in this redesignation, we did not have City Council approve again some of the financial incentives that we've had in prior years. Everyone is going through budget issues. Everyone's looking for sources of revenue. In the prior years, we had 10% reduction in building permit fees that we had in addition to the benefits of the exemption with the enterprise zone. And I certainly know that even though some stuff is confidential with respect to incentives from the city, there's a public process and council would be looking in, and obviously that's part of the public's too, if we were going to be giving them something else in addition to the exemption. And so the process to get the designation involves the public. Certainly the benefits to the community and the businesses is something that is public. So without real specifics of what project you felt was getting a lot more and what wasn't provided to the community, I don't know, but I know for the City of Salem, in order to get, SDC some exorbitant type of benefit, it would require a public process. It would go in front of City Council to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So in light of that, does the City of Salem have a policy on how much in dollar terms they're willing to abate and how much in dollar terms of incentives they're willing to give to a company per job that's created? they have a policy that says this is too much, or if it's under this, we will do it. If it's, you know, when does it become too expensive for the taxpayer?
With respect to the three-year exemption, we follow the state's requirements for what's required. If someone wanted an exemption to five-year, we could add additional conditions to that, and it would be based on a project-by-project basis. And again, that would go through City Council, and they would have to agree to those additional conditions or incentives, whatever they would be.
So they have no set policy on how much is too expensive?
Again, the state requires businesses provide certain benefits to the community. Obviously, we would adhere to that. Anything else would require the City Council approval.
Well, Mr. Chair, but I believe the state requirements leave that decision up to localities as to establish what those requirements are within an enterprise zone.
Well, they mandate some, and then you have the ability to have additional ones?
Correct.
You're absolutely correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to put us back on point here, because I think we're getting off point, I'm going to sum this up very simplistically. For a three-year period, you want 50% of something or 100% of nothing. Because that's what you're talking about. There's nothing secretive about this process. Your City Council has to vent this out in an arena and a public hearing to where people can put input. Anytime you cannot have a City Council assemble and make a deal without having the public there, that's against the law. So therefore, everything involved in these enterprise zones, at least what I've seen from my municipality, has been nothing but a public process. We've heard in the past of people coming in for a three-year period and then leaving. We have not experienced that in Southern Oregon. We have a substantial number of growth from our enterprise zones. We have BOC gases. We have Certainty Corporation. We have Amy's Kitchen. We have the rebuilding of a mill that burnt down, Boise Cascade. We have a lot of entities that are still there today and have been there for years and years. But again, I get back to this process of you're talking, when we talk about loss of revenue, you're talking about loss of revenue of something you don't have in the first place. You're competing with every place in the world, every place in the United States. And if you don't want to be competitive, I guess that's up to the local jurisdiction. But I personally think that it's a great tool for my municipality. I don't believe in opt-outs. I don't believe that it's being misused. And I don't believe it's detrimental to the taxpayer. The one thing that we don't realize is that, let's take Amy's Kitchen down in our neck of the woods. We have 450 people that are working there that, you know what, folks? 3 years ago, they weren't. Think about the revenue impact that has on the state of Oregon. Certainty Corporation, 125 people. BOC Gases, 43 people. That's just to name a few. Boise Cascade, I believe about 450. That's all I'll say.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel. Anything further for Ms. Wargren at this point? Not seeing or hearing anything. Thank you very much for your testimony. As we move forward with the list of witnesses, I would be particularly interested, those of you who remain to testify, we clearly seem to have two issues at stake here on this bill, and one is a need for public information. And the other one is a need to be able to cloak at least some modicum of proprietary information. And rather than just coming down yes or no on this issue, I would find it exceedingly helpful if folks could help us find some middle ground on these two competing points of view. With that, I'd like to call forward a panel consisting of Jack Eiselman, Renee Mengelberg, Gerald Baugh, and John Southgate, please. Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our subcommittee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Eiselman of Tonkin Torp here today with the Oregon Economic Development Association. Representative Huffman, a moment ago, mentioned it would be helpful to hear from some frontline negotiators on these economic development transactions, and I'm pleased to present three of them here to you now. The Oregon Economic Development Association, by way of introduction, is a statewide association of these frontline economic development professionals who work on business retention and recruitment on a daily basis throughout Oregon. And we're prepared to speak to the two issues, Chair Witt, that you have highlighted, and we'll start with Renata.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Renata Mengelberg. I'm an executive committee member for the Oregon Economic Development Association. I'm also an enterprise zone manager for the Milwaukee North Clackamas Enterprise Zone, the Estacada Enterprise Zone, and the Malala Enterprise Zone. We're here on behalf of the association in opposition to House Bill 2429. We feel the Enterprise Zone program is working very well as is. It's a great business recruitment and retention tool that brings traded sector companies to our communities, well-paying jobs, and assessed value that support public services. We think it's working. We strongly oppose the local opt-out provision for fire and school districts. We feel it complicates the program. It makes it much more complicated for our assessors to determine what the benefit would be and then to assess the investment back each year. It's also complicated for our businesses to understand what exactly the benefit will be and might scare some of them away. So any added complexity takes away from the effectiveness of the tool. Also, I wanted to clarify a little bit how enterprise zone managers work with their taxing districts throughout the process. I just went through the process 2 years ago in Malala and last year in Estacada. So firsthand experience, we work very closely with our taxing district. We sent out a notice which provides a lot of information and background on the enterprise zone program, invite them to a public meeting. In fact, in the handout that I gave you today, I gave you the agendas and minutes for both of those hearings so you can understand how inclusive we try to be. We answer their questions, we help them understand how the program will impact them, and we try to address their concerns. And then we work with them on an annual basis throughout the course of the program, reporting back on the companies that are involved in the program and marketing efforts and other information that we think might be of interest to them. So we're in regular contact with all of the affected taxing districts in the enterprise zones that we serve. In the public hearing process for both of those, we were pleased to hear support from school districts. In fact, several wrote letters of support to our various applications. We heard very little opposition from the fire districts, no active opposition. Once they understood the overall long-term benefits to the community in terms of well-paying jobs and investment, they understood and seemed willing to accept the short-term reduction in revenues to their districts because the impact is relatively minor. It's only 3 to 5 years, and it's spread over a few companies. I'd like to also address the sensitivity around disclosing confidential information, particularly employment information. Yes, as an enterprise zone manager, I have a responsibility, as does the assessor, to make sure that the companies are meeting the terms of their agreement. They do provide that information. We scrutinize it carefully, and if there's any issues, we address that with them. But some of them include names and salaries and social security numbers. That's not information that anyone wants public. It's competitive information. It's very sensitive. And if businesses felt that that information would be made public, they would possibly walk away from the program. So it's something that we feel strongly about would jeopardize the program if that were added. So thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to move through your panel, and then we'll ask questions from all of you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is John Southgate, Director of Economic Development for the City of Hillsborough. I concur with all of Renata's comments, but I'd like to focus specifically on the non-disclosure issue, and I think I could safely answer the question in the affirmative as to whether or not this would cause a company to determine not to consider Hillsborough or other communities in Oregon. I met with a number of companies over the last several years, and sometimes they do require us to sign non-disclosure documents before they will proceed in further in discussions with us. And I would surmise, I don't always know the reasons why this particular company is very careful with even their identity being known yet. It might be because they don't want their competition to know we're considering moving to Oregon, and that will convey something to their competition about their strategic direction for their company. There could be a number of reasons why they need to be very careful about that, but I do know that I am certain that some companies would simply take us off the list. In working with recruitment efforts, I think typically a company will start with a pretty big list of potential sites, and both within this country, within the state, but even around the globe. We're competing globally, as I've already said, and I think the recruiters in particular are looking for excuses to take us off the list. They need to start to focus down. They don't want to spend 2 years looking at every possible place. They want to be able to narrow it down to the top 3 to 5. And if we do something as simple as not signing a non-disclosure document, it makes it easy. All right, Hillsborough's out because Austin did sign it, and we need to keep confidentiality at this point. I believe, certainly in the case of Hillsborough, ultimately this is all public record. You can't build a building without getting a permit. That's public record. If you are taking advantage of the enterprise zone tax abatement, that's a matter of public record. If I am curious about this company as just a regular citizen, whether or not it's getting an abatement, I could go check with the tax assessor's records. I could also go call John Southgate in the city of Hillsborough and saying, is this company taking advantage of the abatement? Yes, it is. You know, for how long and what's the level of the abatement? That's public information. But what's of critical importance to me is that during the recruitment process, some companies do not want their identity divulged. And if we are forced to divulge it, we will lose those companies. That's my testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gerald Baugh. I'm with the Portland Development Commission and work with the Enterprise Zone as well. One of the things that I would come back and talk about in this case is going to be relating to the confidentiality. Businesses, when they're looking for opportunities and places to locate, look for 5 things. A favorable climate, certainty in the decision-making, a qualified workforce, the protection of proprietary information and procedures, and a supportive local government. Prior to 1995, when we were doing recruitment, we were basically on a date. In order for somebody to locate into a particular area, particularly if you were from another state, you needed to visit that area, that state, and get familiar with what was going on. Now we get shopped by the Internet, and you can look for sites worldwide with the advantage of being right at your computer. Our ability to deal with these folks, and we're dealing with folks now that are looking at Oregon from around the world, and we're in a position where confidentiality is of the utmost importance. We're not looking at and competing against Washington or Arizona or Idaho or Texas. We're now competing against, is a company going to locate a facility or a business in the United States, or are they going to do it in Asia? And one of the things that we're dealing with in through all of this, as Mr. Southgate has indicated, confidentiality is of the utmost importance. I can't stress enough the importance of building a strong public-private partnership, which business relies on to make a lot of its decisions. And the key for us in dealing with this is to be in a position where we can work with that company, allow us to get to the short list. The Internet is real time. the Internet and information around it affects our ability to deal with things. If we establish a reputation, good or bad, it's on the Internet. What we want to do is work as hard as we can to benefit Oregon, especially in this economy, have ourselves being shown in a very favorable light and a place that's welcoming and certain for business and a very positive business location. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Yes, Representative Bowlby.
Well, thank you. I appreciate, you know, your comments, and I appreciate, you know, your position on this, but I guess from my perspective, in lieu of the recent report we got from the Department of Revenue on enterprise zones statewide, I remain concerned that, you know, the value produced in these enterprise zones and the relationship of the increased amount of jobs and the wage levels are not much different than areas outside of the enterprise zones. And so as we're you know, using public dollars to make these deals, and albeit I'm not going to say that enterprise zones are bad or don't have any value, but, you know, I think that it's important that we know that there is actually a benefit in value to the community on enterprise zones, on specific projects. And how do you do that and have enough disclosure so that we can ensure that there is a positive net value to the state of Oregon in enterprise zones if you are veiled in confidentiality? That's my concern, and so it goes back to the comment of that Representative Esquivel made. I'm glad he just walked back in of 100% of nothing or 50% of something. You know, well, if it's 50% of a loss in value or a loss of benefit, you know, I think you would be better off with 100% of no giveaway. And so, I mean, that's the question that has to be asked, and you can't do that if everything's confidential. So, I mean, that's my perspective on it, and I'm certainly, you know, a lot of more about enterprise zones than I do, but, you know, the Department of Revenue in their review of enterprise zones does not give me any confidence that, you know, that these zones are necessarily, in and of themselves, always a benefit to the community. So certainly sometimes they are, but I can point to many that have not been. So, you know, I guess that's my concern.
I can say that in our area, we get leads that come to us specifically because we have an enterprise zone. They would be looking elsewhere if we didn't offer it. And we're a fairly conservative county. That's the only incentive that we can offer in our hard-hit communities in Mullala and Estacada. They're a bit far afield of the metro area. They probably wouldn't get any attention otherwise. And I can say in both Mullala and Estacada's case, once we form the enterprise zone, we've got two companies in each community that are there because of that enterprise zone creating jobs. And in talking with, I reached out to all of our companies just recently, several of them are expanding and reinvesting.
We'll follow up, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that. My point was not an attack on enterprise zones per se. I think that they are useful tools for recruitment. I guess my concern is how do we establish individual projects whether or not there's a value to the a net positive value to the community with on a given particular project if it's veiled in confidentiality. That again is my concern.
Chair Witt and Representative Holvey, if I could just make one point of clarification on the confidentiality requirements. The confidentiality really only occurs at the inception, at the front end, while the project's being considered. After that, Art Fish, who's the manager of the incentive for the department, is here, and he can explain more to you if you want to get into the technicalities. But there are rigorous reporting requirements that come back both to the zone sponsor and to the state. So we get a tremendous amount of data. I don't think the issue is really a surfeit of data or a lack of data that's available in terms of scrutinizing these investments. Now, how we go about scrutinizing it, that's That's another question. And the efficacy of the tool, that's another question that's probably beyond the scope of this bill and these amendments. But I can give you one quick example. Representative Esquivel mentioned Amy's Kitchen. I was working for the governor when we did that recruitment. We flew down to Santa Rosa. And that was cloaked in confidentiality. I'll tell you why. Amy's Kitchen was founded, actually, in Amy's parents' kitchen in Santa Rosa. That's how the company derived its name. This was a very small family. It had grown out of a very small family concern. And the founders of that company didn't want their employees to know. We were in a pitch battle with California, and there was a question whether they would add in Santa Rosa or come up to Medford. And that was going to be disruptive, potentially, for some of their employees. And they thought about these employees like family. And they felt, and we felt, it was their right to communicate that news to them on their terms, not in the newspaper, not by making some filing with the government. They should let their employees know their expansion plans on their terms. And that was the reason for the confidentiality there. There are different reasons for confidentiality in every deal. But I can say, for the most part, I mean, local governments don't enter into these confidentiality agreements lightly. And moreover, we're the most anxious to tell everyone about it because it's proof that we're getting the job done. So I think we want to blow the confidentiality as soon as anybody else does. And there's always pressure from the media who wants to know about it. And I'll tell you, when I left the department, I was on the other side and wasn't doing these deals anymore. And I was out of the secret loop, and it was painful for a little while because you don't know what's going on. So I can hear Mr. Shipwreck's pain when you see those cranes on the side of, what are those guys doing over there? So maybe we could find a way to create an amendment that gets him in all the non-disclosure agreements. I'd certainly support that.
I'm going to ask for questions from Vice Chair Huffman and Representative Esquivel's on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize you guys only represent 3 of, 50 or something like that throughout the state, enterprise zones, but in your experience that you're representing here today, the cloak of secrecy, has it, in your experience, ever come to the point where it excluded opportunities for Oregon contractors? Because if I'm understanding, I think that's part of the question here.
The Enterprise Zone program comes into the decision of whether a company locates in a community or doesn't. Once they decide to locate, then there's lots of opportunity for construction and employment. In fact, as one of the requirements of the program is to work with our local four-source hiring agreement. So, in theory, Clackamas County residents have a greater shot at these new jobs that are being created than others, depending on their qualifications.
I'd agree with that. Representative Huffman, and add that we work aggressively with through our relationship with the chamber to line up not just workforce but also suppliers, vendors. Generally, a company that once they've decided to come to our community, they want to be good neighbors, so they want to hire local, contract local. They do get involved in the chamber. It's in their self-interest. So to answer your question, no, I'm never aware of an instance where a company, because of our non-disclosure agreement, harmed Oregon either workers or companies. And I think, again, to the contrary, by bringing these new companies in, it generates more economic activity locally.
We too encourage, like the other two communities, to hire locally. So we're looking at not only trying to bring that company in, but also trying to benefit local suppliers and contractors for the opportunities that are presented by the new company.
Please.
One last quick question regarding something that was mentioned early in the bill, and we kind of got off on the secrecy and whatnot, but the special district opting out. In your experience, has there been a problem? Have you had, through your negotiating, have you had special districts coming saying, we don't want to be a part of this deal, we want to be able to opt out, or, has there been a fire district or a school or anybody else, has this been an issue?
Not to my knowledge in my district.
In the Milwaukee North Clackamas area, Fire District 1 has been probably among the most vocal proponents in the state for their concern about lost revenue and impact around the Precision Cast Parts expansion in particular. We did meet with them three times to, as we talked about expanding our enterprise zone, to see if there were some ways that we could help mitigate the impact. We offered several proposals, and the ball was in their court. They didn't come back with specific ideas.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just received a document here to give some people here in the room an idea of what impact it's had on my particular area. Since 1998, in the involvement of the city of my city and county on enterprise zones, we've had 25 three-year commitments on enterprise zones. We've had 26 five-year commitments. Of that, we've created 1,340 new jobs, retained and expanded 3,887 jobs. We have also had a total investment of $120,964,000. So it's almost $121 million. These are longtime companies. These companies, every one of these companies, are still in my area. So we are very successful in this. Now, as for the secrecy part, these were all coded when I was on Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development Board and serving as the president. Why? Very secret. Because, I'm going to give you an example of what we did in the city, which was atrocious. We had an area outside the city, it was 130-some acres, that we wanted to purchase for a park because it was the only 130-some acre piece within the urban growth boundary for a sports park. Well, before we had written a earnest money agreement to purchase that property, word came to the owner that the city was interested and was going to make him an offer on that property. It immediately went up $1 million. That's why you have secrecy until such time it's announced and they've usually acquired the property at that point. Then the announcement, and then everything becomes public. Because if you do it prior to that, you jeopardize the whole project. Mm-hmm. $1 million hit for the city was substantial. And I'd like to wring somebody's neck that went out and told the guy. But that's why we do those things. And thanks for your help on Amy's Kitchen. It's been a great, great neighbor and a good contributor to our community.
Thank you. Representative Volvey.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. And I'm not going to dispute the success in Medford of Amy's Kitchen and all, but I will note that in my area, we've had over the last 10 years anyway, we've had a couple major employers who took advantage of enterprise zones and then folded up and left 1,500 people unemployed. Those things, you hear about the jobs they created, but you don't always hear about what happens when they leave. And specifically about getting back to the confidentiality on these things, and you haven't had experiences where contractors, are always hired local. I can point to one that was veiled in confidentiality, and before anybody knew it, in Lebanon, the Lowe's Center had contracted out to a contractor, and I can't remember whether it was Utah or Florida or I think it was one of those two, and they brought up an entire crew from Southern California and were paid less than 50% of the going rate in that area to do the construction. So, and that was all done in confidentiality. So, I'm glad that everybody sees all the successes, but I've also seen some pretty big examples of how this confidentiality has not really benefited local contractors. So I wanted to point that out.
Chair Holvey, Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, if I can respond to that. In terms of the companies that take advantage of enterprise zones and then close or downsize their business, in the early stage, if they do that, there are provisions in the law to get the benefit we gave them back. So if they leave down the road, as you know, has been the case with some companies in your district, we have at least received the benefit of them being there for that period of time, and they should have paid back the incentive through that period. So I think there are provisions in the program to get at that. Your second point, I'm not convinced there are provisions in the program to ensure that we have local contracting, and I think what happened in the situation you described shouldn't happen. And I know that's OEDA's position. And we would like to work with advocates of your position to make that right. We may disagree over mechanisms to do that, but we would agree that if you're laying out this abatement, there should not only be opportunities for local residents to work at the project once it's constructed, but they should be working there while it's built. And I don't think there's any disagreement about that, and there's a sincere desire on our part to work towards mechanisms that get at that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, yeah. Representative Dembrough.
Well, I'm very happy to hear you say that, Jack. And I'm just wondering if you see how, you know, getting to that point could be in conflict with confidentiality. I mean, do you see a problem there? Because I think that's the core of the concern here.
Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough. You know, confidentiality can go too far. I mean, I think the Google example, and I wasn't involved in that transaction, but that was, you know, to Mr. Shipwreck's point, that was the world's worst kept secret. And they maintained the secret, you know, probably long after the horse was out of the barn. And some of those are idiosyncratic behaviors of, you know, the enterprises we pursue. Now, I don't know whether that impacted, I have not heard that impacted negatively, you know, that kind of preoccupation with secrecy negatively impacted local hiring of contractors. One could see where that might happen, and I think certainly making companies who participate in the benefits of the zone aware that we have an expectation that they are going to look first to hire local contractors when they come to build these plants, and they're going to look to announce that they're breaking ground. But again, I mean, the elected official, and you guys can probably relate to this, I mean, if we're going to put a shovel on the ground, I mean, we want everyone there to see it. So, you know, I think for the most part, the confidentiality, I mean, there's a lot of factors at work to lift the confidentiality as soon as possible. But getting at this notion of making sure our local contractors get the first bite of the apple, I think there are things we could build into the enterprise zone program to get at that. I don't think you want to. The challenge with confidentiality, not to be crass about this, but if you put in legislation that says there's no non-compete, I mean, you know, you can't be half pregnant. I mean, it's either secret or it isn't. It can't be kind of sort of secret. So it's very difficult, I think, to craft kind of a middle ground there. But I do think we can put requirements on zone participants to look first, to hire local contractors, and get that word out as early as possible. And I think that's within our reach.
And Jack, I appreciate very much your sensitivity to the needs of both sides here. But I am concerned about some of the examples that Representative Holvey gave, and I have to believe that in the instance where a company that's looking to locate and has a designated favorite contractor is going to do that up front while they're cloaked in non-disclosure. They're certainly not going to want to do it afterwards. And from the enterprise zone's perspective, those that are smart enough to initiate clawback provisions
I have to believe that you would notify a potential company that there's a clawback provision. Again, while it's cloaked, I mean, you're not going to do that as an oh by the way after the fact. In both of these instances, are precisely the kinds of things when we're involving the public's money and trying to develop and encourage economic development that the public's going to want to have input in. I can't believe that when Representative Holvey's community goes through the recruitment of another company, that they're not going to be entirely focused on how long are you going to be in our community, how many jobs are you going to create, at what cost are they going to be created, and what's the tenure of the employment. I mean, I just think those are fundamental, and I think based on his community's experience, they're going to demand that level of public knowledge and ability for input. So there's the dilemma that we face.
Yeah. Chair Holvey. Chair, gosh, I keep promoting you today.
No promotion here, Representative Holvey.
Chair, Representative Holvey.
3 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, I think I hear what you're getting at, and I think there are kind of two issues within that. I mean, you know, Mr. Baugh referenced, you know, these recruitments are somewhat like going on a date. And unfortunately, you know, you can put all kinds of rigor in the enterprise zone, you're still going to have some bad dates.
Yeah.
And there's no two ways about it. The clawbacks are part of state law. This body, put that in there. So you have afforded taxpayers, I think, that level of protection that if things go south fast, people can't just come in and take the money and run, if you will, and there's an expectation. You're right. I mean, I think there are instances where people are going to have their generals lined up. You know, how that reverberates down to the subs, you know, I don't know. And it's that's a challenge because I don't know how you write something in the law that doesn't kind of blow up all the confidentiality and throw the baby out with the bathwater. So, you know, I think that's a challenge, but I do think this body has within it the ability to make clear through law that we have an expectation that, you know, but to my earlier point, that you're not only going to hire Oregonians to work in your plant, you're going to hire Oregonians to build your plant. And I think we can do that. And the question is, how do we get to that? And we have some disagreement over that, as you know. We'll talk about that in the full committee. But I think we can send that message. And remember, this is an enabling tool. I think you made an excellent point, Chair Witt. If the local community gets burned by this, they're going to demand that their local electeds, their zone sponsors, put in provisions to get at the types of problems they're seeing with the enterprise zone, or they'll just cut it off entirely. And that's all within the purview and the province of the local government. So don't forget that they have many tools at their disposal that may not be as blunt as the tools at your disposal in terms of getting at these problems.
Representative Escobel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To talk about this subject, the three main contractors we have in my area have built most of these, if not all of these, enterprise zone projects. The sad part about it is the school district, we ended up with an outfit out of Utah with a $190 million bond to build our schools. So who's the real culprit here? Certainly wasn't the private entities. It was ourselves, the public sector. I had a bill in with Representative Klim that I still think is a great bill, but I guess it's run to something like against the law or something. But
details, Representative.
Minor details. And what I wanted to do was, if you had brick and mortar within your county, you had a 7.5% advantage on all public bids, 5% within the state, and 2.5% in the United States and out of the country, nothing. But I guess it's against the law, which is unfortunate. But anyway, our people seem to work in our county, but the only one that has really been disruptive was a public project that brought people in and the money went out of our county, which is unfortunate.
Well, panelists, thank you very, very much for your excellent testimony, and certainly appreciate your sensitivities to both sides of the challenge that that we're facing. Your testimony, I think, was excellent. Thank you for your presentations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last person that I have signed up on the sign-up sheet is Ron Patzdorf, please, City of Gresham. Was there anyone else that was intending to testify on this bill? Any hands out in the audience? Okay, thank you very much. Welcome.
Morning, Chair Witt. Representatives of the subcommittee, for the record, Ron Papsdorf for the City of Gresham, Government Relations Manager. And the previous panel, there's been a lot of excellent testimony, so I don't want to rehash a lot of the same points for you, sensitive to the time. But I did want to just emphasize a couple of points, if you'll indulge me, and perhaps add a little bit of clarity from a local government standpoint. And again, the previous panel did an excellent job. But I think our experience is the confidentiality agreements really only apply during that site selection process. The creation of an enterprise zone is a very public process. It takes a local government decision by the governing body of the local jurisdiction. That's a very public process. The public knows the enterprise zone is being created, what that general benefit is to subsequent projects. And the granting of an abatement under the Enterprise Zone program is a very public process. There's no secret once a location decision has been made by a company and the actual granting of the abatement under the established Enterprise Zone. I did want to talk a little bit about the opt-out and not just say that we think it's a bad idea. We think it's an unfair idea. We're talking about an Enterprise Zone being a relatively short abatement program, 3 years in many cases, up to a maximum of 5 year abatement. So it's a short-term property tax abatement only on the new investment. If certain taxing districts are allowed to opt out of the enterprise zone, that means they're not putting any skin in the game in terms of the abatement to attract this new investment that adds long-term value to their property tax revenues. But they're getting that benefit at the end of the abatement period. So it's patently unfair to the other taxing districts that are would be participants in the Enterprise Zone abatement program. Finally, unfortunately, Representative Holvey had to step out, but I did want to talk a little bit about the local decision-making about creation of an enterprise, designation of an enterprise zone, and the awarding of an enterprise zone abatement to a particular project. Gresham has gone beyond the minimum state requirements and established several additional qualifying criteria for a company to take advantage of the abatement. They include a minimum investment level, minimum salary levels for employment, a local procurement plan to make sure that these companies actually are procuring as many supplies and materials from local vendors in our community. So those things all were important to our city council when they created our enterprise zone. The cost per job is not of utmost importance to our community, simply because this is not an income tax abatement, it's a property tax abatement. So what's of most value to us is how much investment is happening long term that's going to create new property tax revenue that's essential to our provision of public safety services, police and fire primarily, which utilizes about 90% of our general fund revenues. That's the key piece, not the cost of that abatement versus the jobs. The jobs are certainly important to our community, and the council values those jobs highly, but it's the value of the investment that really is our measuring stick when deciding about granting the abatement to a qualifying company. And with that, I'll wind up. I know you've been at this for a long time. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to those issues.
Ron, thank you very, very much. Representative Eskimo,
one good question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Do you have an e-commerce overlay as well as your enterprise zone?
Chair Witt, Representative Eskimo, we do not.
Okay.
Anything additional? Thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your coming out today. Last and final call for anyone who wishes to testify on House Bill 2429. Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill, and I'm going to open a
public hearing on House Bill 3127. Kevin, can you give us a brief rundown on this bill?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, House Bill 3127 is before you. In large part, this would the bill itself establishes within the CCB, the Construction Contractors Board, a board of locksmiths, establishes the requirements of the board, including things such as subpoena power, licensing, and creates other responsibilities. There is a dash one amendment that I circulated, and with your package today, the dash one amendment narrows the scope of the original bill. Essentially prohibits a business from undertaking, still within the rubric of the CCB, prohibits a business from undertaking locksmith smith services unless the business is licensed by the CCB and has an owner employee who is certified as a locksmith. Again, it sets forth certain requirements. What's being distributed to you right now is the fiscal statement with 3127 that was just finalized literally within probably the last few minutes. And if Robin Lamont is working on this, thank you very much for banging this thing out last minute. But I've known Representative Huffman and there's some other people here to testify with respect to it.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to have Representative Huffman come forward first, please. And Vice Chair, I don't know if you have other folks that you want to introduce.
I have a small panel, okay. Mr. Chair. How about Simon Blatz and Les Harvey, if they could join me up here, I would appreciate that. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, John Huffman, State Representative for District 59. And I was disappointed to see Commissioner Preuss left our hearing a little early. I was going to ask her if my locksmiths in the room could get some college credit for everything they learned about enterprise zones and everything. I appreciate them joining us today. We have can the locksmiths in the room raise your hands just to...
Oh, my.
Okay, excellent. I appreciate you guys coming and enduring the enterprise zone testimony. You know, the bill that I'm going to present today, 3127, really is not that dissimilar to a couple of things that I think we passed them both on the House floor yesterday that kind of skirted some of the issues that we've got to present here this morning for the Locksmith Association. We passed a bill yesterday for florists, and it was a consumer protection bill where... You know, florists from God knows where advertise in the phone book, and they're kind of a middleman, and we felt that it was important for the consumer to understand who they were talking to, what state or what country they were in, and that they weren't necessarily buying their flowers locally. And some other issues surrounding that. But and then there was another about... That also relates to this, and it had to do with movers and making sure that the people that come into our home and deal with our goods and stuff had background checks and you know, kind of a security issue, making sure that the movers were following the rules and we could trust them to be in our homes. But before I get along here too far, I want to thank Ernie Blatz from Ernie's Locks and Keys in the Dalles, a longtime friend and a gentleman that I've worked with on many, many community and public projects, the building of a new middle school in the Dalles not too many years ago, and we've worked together on a lot of community projects. But Ernie is the president of the Pacific Locksmith Association, and he's with us this morning, so I appreciate him driving over from the Dalles. The Pacific Locksmith Association has had growing concerns about scams that have not just concerns about scams, but scams that have been perpetrated upon consumers in Oregon within the lock and safe industry in Oregon. And so they came to me, and many people in this room have worked much longer and harder on this bill than I have, and I just really appreciate the dedication of everybody working toward this, because I think it is a good bill. And one of the people in the room is Craig Smith from Construction Contractors Board. Did I get that close to right, Craig? Okay. CCB. We know who I'm talking about anyway. And I just wanted to point out that Craig has been very instrumental in helping us craft a bill that could work for CCB in oversight of this association, and recommended that we amend the original bill, which was broader in scope, could have had a fiscal impact, a negative fiscal impact, to create something that was neutral, that helped the consumer, helped the locksmiths regulate their industry, and align it basically with a program for that's similar to home inspectors. So it's not anything that is unlike what CCB is already assisting other industries to help regulate. I'm not going to talk much more. I'm going to turn it over here to Simon Blatz, who is now living in Eugene, a student at U of O, and owner of Precision Lockout Service, serving Eugene and Lane County, certified journeyman safe cracker and trainer. And Simon's going to tell you about some of the problems affecting consumers, and then we're going to turn it over to Les Harvey, president of Precision Locksmith Service out of Beaverton. And Les is a longtime locksmith, and his company provides a full range of locksmithing services. And Les will briefly describe how the amendment will help solve some of the problems that they perceive in the industry and for consumers. And so, Simon, take it away, and you have to tell us what your name is, even though I just did.
For the record, my name is Simon Blatz, Mr. Chairman and the committee. Thank you for your time, and I will do my best to respect it by being as concise as possible. Nationwide and in Oregon, illegitimate locksmiths from out of state and out of country are ripping off consumers with shoddy workmanship and bait-and-switch schemes regarding their charges for service. Consumers think that all locksmiths are licensed, trained, professional individuals. Since this is not true, illegitimate locksmiths are taking advantage of consumers in three ways. First, they're using fraudulent addresses and licensure to appear local in phone books and advertising. Second is charging 2 to 3 times the standard rates. And third is decreasing the security of consumers' cars, homes, and businesses through their unskilled labor. Now, gentlemen, maybe you haven't experienced this problem firsthand in your community yet, but it is spreading. If the committee would like to see, here are the Portland and Clackamas phone books that I'd want to thank Dennis Petrin, a Clackamas locksmith who brought the bill idea to the legislator and helped with all the phone books. All the tab pages and highlights are illegal locksmiths in the Dex Yellow Pages. In your packets that we've handed out, there is national coverage from the Locksmith Wiki, list of new reports and complaint filings from the Better Business Bureau. You'll also see that in other states, general attorneys filing class action lawsuits against these con artists. A Federal Trade Commission's consumer alert and local KATU news articles covering the imposters taking advantages of Oregon consumers. The attorney generals have even disconnected phone lines and removed online advertisements to protect the public. These 1-800 rip-me-offs individuals are not endangering the are not only endangering the uninformed person, but are damaging the legitimate locksmithing businesses in these current economic times. Every time one of these crooks hurts one of the consumers, it hurts the credibility of the rest of us. Legitimate locksmiths and the whole industry suffers. We believe it is good public policy to certify locksmiths protecting consumers. This brings us to the solution.
Thank you very much. Would you prefer, Representative Huffman, to have your two panel members go before we ask questions?
Mr. Chair, it's totally up to you. If questions come to mind, I'm sure we would be more than happy to field them now. It's totally your pleasure.
Anyone have anything pressing?
I'd like to hear the solution, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So do I.
Hopefully I'm able
to put a lock on this. So.
Address that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Les Harvey, as always, already been indicated. I own Precision Locksmith Service based in Beaverton, and you've heard from Simon some of the problems that we're dealing with, and hopefully we're here to start the process of what we can do to help protect the public. And that is what I want to focus on, is protecting the public, because locksmiths were fiercely independent, mostly mom-and-pop businesses, and we don't like government involvement. But here we are in front of you today because these outside companies that are not playing by the same rules as we are coming in. They're portraying themselves as local locksmiths, where in fact the dispatching typically goes out of state and then comes back to locksmiths or people that they have locally who are, as far as I know, not licensed through the CCB or, as far as I know, through any other city licensing or anything like that. So what can we do to help protect the public from these unscrupulous locksmiths? That's why we're here. Currently, the businesses are supposed to be licensed through the CCB. A lot of these unscrupulous locksmiths are not, because the companies are based out of state. And then they get these other people to come in to town, and it's the local people feel like the companies are taking care of all the problems or taking care of all the legal issues, whereas so what we feel like will solve the issue is that we want to license the individual locksmiths. Most people, the public, assumes already that there's some mechanism that regulates our industry, that there's some screening process so that the person that comes out to your home, your business, or your locked car that might be in a dark parking lot some night when you're locked out, that there's been some process that says that, you know, these aren't your violent criminals. But it could very well be a violent criminal because there are no current regulations on our industry. There's no background checks, very little job training on some of these people. You're handing out literally the keys to your whole personal life, your business, and everything else. What we're proposing is this House Bill 3127, and I want to emphasize that we are here talking about the Dash 1 amendments. Since it was originally submitted to LC, we've had more meetings with Craig Smith, who's been very nice to work with, and I appreciate his help. And we understand his restraints, and we've modified it so that hopefully it has it still gets us what we feel the public needs, what we want, but also falls within the confines of what he's able to do. What we propose to do is actually certify each individual locksmith, not the companies. The CCB, the company, the business will still need to be certified under the current CCB licenses, whatever they currently have. What we want to do is certify the individual locksmiths. That includes a background check to make sure they're of a good moral character. We also want to have some standards implemented to provide that there's at least some minimum standards as far as their abilities, which would include some sort of testing process. Establish some standards of professional conduct as far as the bait and switch schemes where they quote one price and things of that nature. We want to focus on locksmiths. We want to narrow it because there are other fields that are related but similar, such as tow operators, low voltage security technicians that may do access control systems, licensed contractors that might need to install a lock in the process of installing a door on a structure. We don't want to license them. They're doing great jobs. We want to focus and narrow our scope to locksmiths. And in speaking with a lot of the locksmiths around the state over the years, most locksmiths really realize that there should be some mechanism for licensing, some mechanism to regulate, to screen people that get into the industry. The only part that they're concerned about in dealing with the government is you don't know how much it's going to cost. So what we're trying to accomplish here is to get these certifications and everything else that goes along with it at a cost that's minimal to the locksmith, but yet is still effective. Our goal is to make this program fiscally neutral, and it's interesting that we've had the cost analysis come out, and I'd be curious to see what is on there. But our goal is to be fiscally neutral. We know the situation, the current economic situation with the government and business. So we have identified around 300 to 400 different locksmith businesses in the state of Oregon. Our research has found that on average there are about 3 individual locksmiths per business. So if we were to assume, just figures out of the air here, that there's a $300 locksmith certification for a 2-year certificate or certification, which averages about $1,250 per month, along with any other application charges and whatnot, should be enough, we think, to cover the expenses that may be incurred by this endeavor. That's about it. We urge your support of this bill and just make sure we're supporting the -1 amendments. And we hope that we're able to move this forward into the House to create something that the public already assumes is in place. So we appreciate your time, and we would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at my computer there. How many locksmiths do we have in the state of Oregon?
Well, that's hard to pin down because the CCB licenses locksmith companies. I'm sorry.
They're estimating 1,800.
Okay. They're estimating 1,829 from the fiscal analysis, which, frankly, is higher than what we had thought. But there are so many people that fly under the radar that even the CCB doesn't even recognize they're out there.
A follow up, please. And you estimate there's 4 people working per entity?
We, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we recommend, or I've spoken with a number of, I've been in the business for 27 years and been heavily involved with the association through classes and trade shows, and I've talked to a lot of the sales reps that go from business to business, and we have a pretty fair idea and it goes anywhere from 1 to, in my case, we have 12 employees. There are some others that have perhaps more, but on average, we estimate about 3 individual locksmiths per company.
Okay, follow up, please. Okay, that's about 7,200 with an average of 4.
Okay.
For 1,800 entities. I have a couple questions here. One is on your education part, you're talking about testing. What is the, have you established some sort of a criteria already in your own mind?
Well,
for testing,
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we, in our original draft that was submitted to LC, had a lot of the information in it, and that changed somewhat, and then it's been, I think you guys referred to it as gutted and stuffed, and now we're at the -1 amendment. Sorry, we're new to this. We're blue-collar people, so just bear with me here. But there are some standardized tests now through the National Association that are recognized through, it's called the Associated Locksmiths of America, which is also...
Then you do have a criteria.
There, okay. That's your question, yes.
And the last question I have you considered bonding?
For the individual locksmiths?
Yes.
We have thought about
$5,000 bond.
I think that may be a good mechanism that, and of course this would be up to the Board of Locksmiths or the administrative rules as it goes forward.
Yeah, last thing.
Please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to see you come forward on this, and I'll tell you why. I am a realtor. We did this in 1919, I believe, because we had curbstoners. That was people that were doing real estate without, we didn't even have a licensing process in those days, and they were so crooked you had to screw them into the ground sometimes, you know. So therefore, we did the same thing. I think you're talking about an entity that will be under the wing of the DCBS, which is okay under that umbrella, but we have a separate entity where all of our monies, there's not one single public dollar in the real estate agency in the state of Oregon. It is all separate, and we pay that as realtors. But I'm glad to see that you're coming forward, because it's a broad brush. Whatever these people do reflect on you personally.
Absolutely.
And professionally. And I'm very, very pleased to see you come forward, all of you.
Thank you very much. Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll echo Representative Esquivel's sentiment. I'm very glad to see your industry step up and come forward to try to solve an issue, not just for your own industry, but for consumers. I chair another committee that deals with these sorts of issues in the consumer world, and you oftentimes get quite a bit of pushback from people, because we're trying to put some regulations in to protect consumers on business practices and trying to certify or license people in certain industries where we see abuses going on. And it's not always an easy road to go down that and create boards and to create licensing programs. And I'm fully supportive of that endeavor that you embark on. I am very little concerned about the startup costs for getting this off the ground and the fiscal impact that could happen. And I know Craig Smith is very good at trying to figure out how to do this without fiscal impacts, but still that's a big challenge to get to that point. And I guess to follow up on that, I mean, there's another avenue that you could also look at besides the bonding requirements, which, of course, will cost your industry and your individuals money. So you got to keep that in mind. But also to look at individual practices that your legitimate business folks operate under, like, you know, do you give, and I guess this is sort of a question, do you, when you go out to do a service, do you give somebody an estimate of what it's going to cost? And if you do so, you know, if that's a good business practice for you, you know, putting into a law a requirement that, locksmiths give a written estimate of what the project or the job's going to cost, even if it's an hourly estimate, that way you can sort of get at one of those issues that you described as being a problem of overcharging and doing things like that. I don't see any of those types of practices in the bill itself, although I think there are the CCB has rulemaking authority to perhaps address some of that, but it's something your industry really needs to think about, is what are those good business practices in your industry that you can either implement through statute or through rule, and to keep that in mind, because if this bill gets derailed because of the fiscal part of trying to create licensing programs and testing programs, it seems like a good step would be to take a step back and identify some business practices that you could implement without cost to the state. And I know Craig has some experience in doing some of that. I don't know, where your particular bill fits into Chapter 701, but, where there are contract provisions and requirements, but those are generally for over $2,000. And so this is sort of a separate animal where you would have to have, specific sort of business practices that you could think about. I don't know if there's, hopefully this bill goes through and Craig can get that stuff done by rule, but just another way of thinking about it might be to think about you know, an incremental piece of just getting some business practices put into statute or rule as well if this looks like it may get derailed by fiscals. Thank you for letting me go on there a little bit.
Chair Witt, Representative Hovey, all of those concerns have been discussed. They were going to be a little more proactive in the initial bill, but those are all goals that both the Locksmith Association has talked with Craig about, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'd love to have Craig come up if he so chooses to maybe kind of express the guidance that he has, but all these things have been discussed, and I think they're still talking about having an advisory board work with CCB in the things like requiring the bonding, you know, written estimates, those types of ideas. We were very careful to make sure that Craig was not put in, because Craig couldn't even come in neutral on this if there was going to be a cost factor attached to it. There are some startups, however, with including each individual locksmith, the cost should easily, if not more than, cover CCB's expenses on this.
Gentlemen, just very briefly here, if someone's not licensed and I contacted an unlicensed locksmith to come in and rekey my home, I've just hired an unknown quantity. Am I wrong? I mean, I could have someone who's making the key to my home putting an extra key in his or her pocket at that point. I mean, we don't know what kind of person I'm hiring, correct?
I assume, since we've got Craig and CCB involved in this, through all advertising of contractors, for example, you have to list your CCB number in your advertising on your truck. You know, Ernie and Les, they're going to have to go to the sign shop and get the vinyl letters to put on their rigs, CCB number XYZ. And so that will denote that they are an approved and authorized unknown entity, if you will, so that you can feel more comfortable in allowing them into your home to or your business to replace the locks. And
I simply cannot believe that it's taken us this long to get to this point. Vice Chair Huffman, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. As Representative Esquivel said, his folks did it a century ago, and I can't think of anything that is probably more important to the public than making sure that we haven't got people going around passing somebody's keys out on the street. I mean, this is absolutely insane that we have waited this long to make this happen, and I think it's a credit to your profession that you're wanting to move forward with this. We're going to have to go very quickly, folks, and I do have someone who's come here to testify on House Bill 2398, and I do not want to disappoint her and send her home without allowing her the opportunity to testify. Representative Esquivel?
Just one quick thing. When you start establishing this, if that goes that far, make sure you have some sort of a criminal activity in the background for licensing, and make sure that it's worded similar to what the attorneys do, because we found as realtors that even though we strive very hard to keep felons out of our business, you could have a convicted pedophile that could get a license in the state of Oregon because of a loophole in the law that we had to stitch up. So be very, very careful, and you could have Joe Blow, the bank robber, or the burglar, the cat burglar, mm-hmm. that we could not deny a license to.
Mr. Chairman,
quickly.
Okay, sorry.
Quickly.
Interestingly enough, they used to teach locksmith things in the penitentiary system.
Very good.
Like robbing banks. You know, why do you rob them?
Thank you, gentlemen. love that little bit of confidence there right at the end.
Hopefully, it's not worth it.
I feel better now, Mr. Jack.
Oh, boy.
Well, so who was teaching the courses?
I have an interesting story in that regard offline later. Okay. Two last people, very quickly, if you would please help the chair on this. Michael Ellsbury and Craig Smith.
Different bill?
No, same bill. Last bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. What I can tell you on this is, of course, that the Construction Contractors Board is neutral. I haven't seen the fiscal in detail. We have provided information to LFO on this. It's difficult to have no cost whenever we're talking about adding a program. The interesting thing on this matter is it looks like the revenue that would be derived from certification revenue would be twice as much as the cost incurred. However, the services probably needed by this additional regulation would cost time and energy. So, you know, there probably is some spending limitation that we're talking about here that's fairly significant, and that may be an issue. There are three issues, I think, before you. First of all, do you need to have some more regulation in this industry, or don't you? Secondly, if so, what kind, what flavor? Third, then, how are you going to do that? You could have a standalone agency. You could have a semi-independent agency. You could have part of another agency. And it goes on and on and on. Here before you, you have a -1 amendment that would create a subcategory in Construction Contractors Board, very similar to your home inspector program. Think of your home inspectors, the people of service, the real estate folks, where they have a certification process. And it's fairly significant. It's fairly detailed. It has its own section in CCB law, in rules. And it works not badly. It works not badly. We also license businesses that do chimney sweeps and trim trees and things like that. The interesting thing about this industry is it's not a perfect fit in the CCB because not all of what these folks do works on houses. Sometimes they work on cars. Sometimes they work on RVs and some other issues like that. So it's not a perfect fit. But it's a fit you could do if you wanted to. I know you're cut for time, so let me conclude with this. We're not looking for additional business. I want you to understand that.
You.
If you think this is the place to put these folks, we'll take care of them and we'll
do
it right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate that offer. Please, sir, Mr. Ellsbury.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Ellsbury. I'm the President and CEO of A&E Security and Electronic Solutions in McMinnville, Oregon. I'm unique in the fact that I'm a certified registered locksmith, as denoted by the National Association, and I'm also a general journeyman electrician within the state of Oregon. I've lived through the implementation of low voltage regulation in the 90s and have seen the benefits of regulation within an industry. While I'm generally in favor of more free market dynamics, I must admit that the regulation process of the low voltage electricians, while not without its faults, has been more of a benefit than not. The basics of the legislation carves out a niche for locksmiths, not unlike we have today for electricians and plumbers, sheet metal workers, and the like. Locksmiths or mechanical security technicians have some interesting talents as described and defined by the proposed legislation. Such abilities to surreptitiously break into your home or your office, as well as safes and vaults. Clearly, it is in the public's best interest to have these individuals licensed and registered to create guidelines of how these types of services are performed and documented. While I substantially support my colleagues, because they've never been before the legislative process before and have not been entangled with regulations as we have as electricians, I wish to be slightly more bold. That being said, another equally concerning issue is the installation and servicing of door hardware as it relates to fire-rated doors and exit paths, as defined by the National Fire Protection Association Handbook 101.
Mr. Ellsbury, I'm terribly sorry, sir, but I have run this committee 7 minutes past its time already. Could you please summarize your statement for us?
The statement is, I believe we should go slightly more further in this legislation. I provided two amendments on the back page of my written submission, that I think we should endeavor in. While this legislation has been very effective in making a start, I believe we have a much larger public safety issue as it relates to electrical mechanical locks. It is my professional opinion that more than 50% of exit path security devices have been installed improperly. Because this entity does not exist, there is no entity or licensed party today that inspects this hardware for functionality. It's one thing that someone can enter your home without you knowing it. It's another thing when someone dies because a fire alarm activates and electronic locking hardware does not unlock. So I would like to say that I wish this legislation to move forward, and I would like it to have a few more components in it to protect the public.
Thank you very much, sir. Certainly appreciate your concern for the public safety. I am going to ask Kevin, please, to address the fiscal on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding with Craig sitting here, I'll look for the nod of the head. This is came out just a few minutes ago. Toward the bottom, paragraph 3, there's a phrase that says total estimate from CCB is approximately $430,000 of other funds and five positions. As I'm understanding, when they say other funds, we're talking about non-general fund dollars. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That's certainly very helpful. And with that, I am going to close the hearing on House Bill 3127, and I'm going to open a work session on this bill. Committee members, we have a dash one amendments. Your pleasure.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3127.
Representative Holby moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3127. Is there any discussion or comments?
Mr. Chair, although I support this bill totally, I wish there was another amendment that might be considered on the other side of this building, or if it goes to Ways and Means, it'd be nice if we could have got another amendment to this bill to use the Unfair Trade Practices Act on certain practices within this industry that would have absolutely no fiscal that could help rein in some of these bad actors in this industry. And from my standpoint, that amendment, if it went to Ways and Means and this fiscal ends up killing this bill, they could have carved out the part of this bill that causes a fiscal impact and perhaps the licensing piece, and we could have had some Unfair Trade Practices Act put in there that the Attorney General could have gone after these bad actors.
Well, and Representative Holby, this is actually going on to the full committee, and we'll have that opportunity at another level here very shortly. Further questions, discussion on the motion? Seeing none, hearing none, I will entertain a motion to the full committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3127 as amended to the full committee on business and labor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Holby moves House Bill 3127 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, that full committee being business and labor. Discussion on the motion, seeing none, hearing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, hearing none, the motion passes. The bill is moved forward. Thank you very much. I am going to close the work session on House Bill 3127, and I am very quickly going to open a work session to entertain on House Bill 2398 to entertain very brief testimony from Kathy McDonald, please.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Kathy McDonald. I represent the Northwest Career College Federation, and we are grateful that you've included us on this bill. You have my written testimony. I would like to read the last paragraph or last sentence. Career schools focus on educating tomorrow's workforce. We commend the speaker and CCWD for bringing forth this legislation as part of a solution for employers' confidence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this and apologize for this. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2398. I'm going to carry it over until Tuesday. With that, any coming events?
Coming events, April 21st, we've got our agendas posted. As you'll see, there's pretty much four bills that we're going to be working on next week. To the extent we need it, 3127 no longer is necessary, but 2429 and also 2398. You've been given the dash four amendments, which are before you. They were received last night, or right before the close of business. They've gone on to fiscal. We're optimistic we will have the fiscal on Tuesday to move it on to the big committee, because there's a vote scheduled on this bill in the big committee tentatively right now on Wednesday. So,
thank you very much. Good of the order. Everybody gets to the House floor real quick. Thank you very much. Close today's session.